Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books. And this week I'm happy to say that we have Donald Critchlow on the show, and we'll be talking about his book, When Hollywood Was Right, How Movie Stars, Studio Moguls, and Big Business Remade American Politics. It's a fascinating book. It shines light on something that I don't think most people know, except by dim association with Ronald Reagan, who they say was a film star and later became, of course, Ronald Reagan, the great Republican god. But there's a whole story behind that, and Don does a really terrific job of telling it, and I'm really glad that he did, because as I say, I'm a big film buff, and I study Hollywood a little bit, just amateurishly, and I really learned a lot from the book, and I hope people go out and buy it. So first, let me say, Donald, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I'm a long practicing historian. I teach history at Arizona State University. I've taught at other places, but now Arizona is my home.
Okay. And we should say that you've written other books of great. I'll say it for you. You wrote a great book about Phyllis Schlafly. Can I just say that?
Well, right? Thank you very much. Yeah, that was one of my earlier books.
I really liked it, so I encourage people to go buy that one, too. So could you tell us why you wrote When Hollywood Was Right?
Well, sure. I was thinking about writing a biography of the relationship, or a collective biography of the odd relationship between Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. And when I was looking at the Richard Nixon papers, I suddenly saw all this correspondence from Hollywood actors. And I thought, gee, I didn't realize so many actors were Republicans. So the more I looked into it, it was a discovery, and I decided that this was a book that should be written. Most people, when I started, said it was going to be, when I told them I was writing about the Hollywood riot, they said, well, that will be a short book. It turned out that there were hundreds and hundreds of Republicans, as well as conservatives, in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s and up through the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, and I think it is a historical corrective. As I said, I think most people, when they think about Hollywood, they think left. And actually, you begin the book that way with an interesting anecdote about Elie Kazan. And well, why don't you tell that little about what happened in, is it 1999?
Yes. Elie Kazan, who had written and directed On the Waterfront, was going to be given a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Motion Picture Academy. And there were huge protests outside the award ceremony. And when he received the award, many of the actors, or a few of the actors who were on the left, stood up and turned their backs. And they felt that he was he had denounced communism, turned his back on the party, and he was a turncoat. So even though he had achieved much in film, and On the Waterfront still remains one of the great films of Hollywood, it was rather shocking, really, that people were still going to hold against him of something that happened, 30 years previously. Mm-hmm. And if one looks at the Communist Party and its activities in Hollywood in this period, they're nothing to really carry a banner for, in my view.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's interesting that it still touches a nerve today. I mean, I think part of the reason, and you can speak about this yourself, is that it's become a kind of cliche, and people have put on white hats and black hats. And so the black hats are the people who were anti-communist, and the white hats are people who were persecuted by the anti-communists. At least that's
right. Well, there've been dozens of films and novels and books written about the the dark days of Hollywood without much of an understanding, really, of what was going on at that time. Mm-hmm. In my opinion,
yeah, no, I think that's right, and that's why it's a good historical corrective. So let's get right into the book. You begin it roughly in the Depression, and then That Which Follows, which is the Roosevelt's reforms, the New Deal, and a particular low point for the Republican Party, particularly in California, which is where you focus your attention.
Yes. Well, in the 1920s and early 1930s, Hollywood wasn't very political. It was always about making money. But when Upton Sinclair won the Democratic Party nomination for governor in 1934, running on a socialist ticket or program in poverty in California, and he talked about kind of taking over the Hollywood studios, the business community with LA Times owner Chandler, and as well as studio heads Louis B. Mayer and others, really mobilized a very extensive and expensive campaign against Sinclair. Involved in this campaign, by the way, this anti-Sinclair campaign, was Earl Warren, who later became longstanding governor of California and Supreme Court justice, seen as a liberal, but he was really kind of the figurehead on, spearhead on the attack on Sinclair. In the end, Sinclair lost the nomination in the most expensive gubernatorial race at that point. It really showed negative advertising and negative attacks and the use of media in a full-blown way, and that was going to basically set the stage for later media use in political campaigns.
Mm-hmm. And at this time, the California Republican Party, I mean, obviously they may have defeated Upton Sinclair, but they could not hold back the New Deal.
Right. Yeah. The New Deal was very popular in California, as it was in the rest of the country. And California Republicans watched their state becoming increasingly Democratic, especially in voter registration. So they were really on the ropes. And it's at that point, really, in the kind of the late in the Second World War and really after the war, that a group came together in Southern California, made up of Hollywood moguls, as well as leading businessmen and actors coming together to really revive the Republican Party. And that was going to set the stage for their successes in the 1960s with the election of, in 1964, of actor Dan Spann, George Murphy, and then later in 1966 with the election of Reagan as governor, and later in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
When he won the presidency.
So much of your book is about anti-communism as an ideological stance and also a kind of platform for mobilization. Could you talk a little bit about this group of people and, first of all, why they were anti-communist? And then, second of all, it'll probably be a little bit down the road, how the issue came to be used as a kind of political tool, if you don't object to that characterization.
No, I think that's fair enough to call it a political tool. Well, the Communist Party in Southern California and in Hollywood was never large, but it gained support of and membership from a number of significant people, and particularly made inroads in Hollywood film industries, particularly the Screenwriters Guild. And so you see authors and screenwriters such as Dalton Trumbo and Dorothy Parker, Albert Maltz, and Rain Lardner Jr. Playing a significant role in the Screenwriters Guild. And at the same time, the communists also made significant inroads in the technical unions in Hollywood, as well as the cartoonist union. And that began to turn the studio heads against him. Walt Disney, for example, after experiencing unionization of his studio, in which he thought was communist-led, he became a virulent anti-communist. And then in 1945 and 1946, there were massive strikes in Hollywood that shut down the studios, but it also led to violence. And at that point, this is at the just at the tail end of the war and the year after, I think it really spurred anti-communist activities in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. And so when was this first used as a campaign device?
Well, at first it wasn't the Republicans were going to seize on the anti-communist issue, but the first signs of kind of the backlash to communism, to communist party involvement in Hollywood came when a group of actors and screenwriters came together to form the Motion Picture Alliance for American Ideals. And this was, they drew actors such as Gary Cooper and Randolph Scott, Spencer Tracy, Clark Gable, Ginger Rogers, Barbara Stanwyck, and Robert Taylor. And a whole group of Ayn Rand came together to confront the communists. And the Motion Picture Alliance wrote to the House on Un-American Activities or to Congress and asked for an investigation of communist involvement in the film industry.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, should I go on?
Yeah, please go on.
Yes, and I don't mean to just speak without giving anyone a break.
But, no, go ahead. It's interesting.
So they wrote Congress, and the head of the House on Un-American Activities Committee called HUAC was headed by J. Pornell Thomas, a New Jersey congressman. And a bit of quite a grandstander, as many on UAC were. And they saw, going to Hollywood was going to create great publicity. And at the same time, the studio heads didn't want Congress coming to Hollywood to talk about communism. They just saw it as bad publicity. And furthermore, they thought they were taking care of the communist problem already. So Thomas and many within the Republican establishment didn't want these hearings either. They were probably influenced by studio heads who were trying to tell them that this was, that this was just grandstanding. And Thomas Dewey, who had run for president and had aspirations of running in 48 as president again, phoned up J. Pornell Thomas and tried to get him to call off the hearings. And in fact, the Republican Speaker of the House, Republicans had just won House for the first time in many years, Joseph Martin, also phoned up Thomas and said, look, this is just going to lead to a backlash. The Republicans will be portrayed as red baggers. Let's don't do this. But J. Pornell Thomas felt that this was his great opportunity And so he came out to Hollywood, and then later had televised hearings in Washington that were watched by across the country, and hundreds of people lined up to get into the committee room to see these hearings. Because being brought to the hearings were America's most popular stars of the day, Gary Cooper, Robert Taylor, Ronald Reagan, and many others. Mm-hmm. Should I go on?
Yeah, I just one question, actually. This is one of the most fascinating parts of the book to me. You already talked about it, but it's just very interesting to me, given the fact that we think of the HUAC hearings as sort of the equivalent of the Inquisition now, and Republican-backed, how many Republicans didn't really want to do it, that they thought it was just a very bad idea? And this is just totally forgotten, well, as far as I know.
Yeah, well, that was a discovery I made in the book, and I don't think it's never been reported before. Yeah. But it's clear that the Republican establishment didn't want these hearings, because they were very concerned about being painted in the next election, 48, as red baiters.
Yeah.
And furthermore, the Republican establishment in California and the Hollywood studios didn't want this investigation. They were very concerned about, you know, the bad publicity. And the fact of the matter was that in the 1940s, during World War II, Hollywood had used very talented writers who were members of the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
Dalton Trumbo, who was one of the most prolific screenwriters and considered one of the most talented, didn't hide that he was a communist.
Mm-hmm.
And during World War II, when the Soviet Union was our ally and fighting the war against the Nazis, Hollywood had made some films that portrayed the Soviet Union in a favorable light.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this wasn't because the Hollywood studios, Louis B. Mayer, were communists. They were fighting, or the Warner Brothers were communists. They just saw it as fighting the fight against fascism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's fascinating. I mean, I guess one of the takeaways is, I'll characterize it myself. I mean, that it was really a close thing. It could have easily gone the wrong way, if not for a kind of peculiarity, which you point out in the book, and that is the response of the unfriendly 10. They do something
right,
which really is in hindsight, I'll sort of save it for drama's purposes. In hindsight, what they did, it looks really great. But actually, at the time, it was tactically a disaster. So go ahead and tell the story of the friendly 10 and the unfriendly 10.
Yes. Well, in order to understand what had happened, at those HUAC hearings in Washington, in which the entire country was watching on television, one needs to understand a change in the Communist Party, their line, the party line, and that came from the Soviet Union. During the late 1930s and during the Second World War, the Communist Party had supported working with liberals in the so-called Popular Front. But as the war drew to a close, Stalin believed that America and England were going to be his enemies, that they were going to become fascist. And so the party changed its line, denounced the Popular Front, denounced liberals, and said that they needed to be now prepared to fight, continue the fight against fascism. So that set the stage. That set the stage for the HUAC hearings. In other words, the Communist Party believed that fascism was on the way, and then you have the HUAC hearings, which confirmed in their own view that yes, fascism was already here. also the lawyers representing the 10 witnesses that were called before HUAC, the so-called unfriendlies who were accused of membership in the Communist Party, decided that they were going to make a political stand to make the HUAC hearings into a show trial. So instead of taking the Fifth Amendment, which later subsequent communists did, that you that said that you wouldn't self-incriminate yourself, they decided to make it a First Amendment free speech issue. So what happened in the first four days of the hearings, the so-called friendlies came before them, Ronald Reagan and Ayn Rand and others, and the investigation had to do with communist propaganda in Hollywood films, and they pointed to two films in particular that they saw were communist: Mission to Moscow and Song of Russia. But other than that, there wasn't a lot of evidence in the films. In other films, some of the so-called friendlies, especially Ayn Rand, said that what the communists did was communist screenwriters did was not write entire propaganda films, but try to sneak in a line or two that was praised the Soviet Union or denounced businessmen or denounced politicians and so forth. Well, one needs to remember that in the New Deal, there was a lot of anti-business sentiment, and many people saw the Soviet Union mistakenly as kind of a workers' paradise. Capitalism had failed, and the Soviet Union seemed to be working. In other words, it was pretty hard to distinguish, you know, liberalism, good liberalism, from communist propaganda. So after the friendlies had testified, the newspapers across the country and most Americans thought this was just a lark, that they had failed to prove their case. This was just grandstanding.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I was going to interrupt. I think we should say, and you can tell me whether this is right, they didn't find any communist propaganda in films, American Hopes, because there wasn't any.
Yeah, I mean,
it's like, you know, it's
right.
Yeah, okay.
Well, there were communists who were involved in writing films, and the party told them if they got the, you know, opportunity to sneak in a line or two, they would.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, but liberals were doing the same thing. That's the point.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, there was a conscious effort, but it wasn't like complete, you know, let's have a revolution, right, and let's bring Stalin over, right, to run the country.
It's not the battleship Potemkin or anything like that.
Right,
and also,
right,
as you point out, you really didn't need to convince many scriptwriters to write bad bankers into their films in 1939 or 40. Bankers already had a bad name. I mean, that was just a natural, you know.
Yeah, right. Let's face it, taking a businessman who's and making him into a buffoon was pretty,
made
for pretty good characters anyway. So everything, so, you know, the HUAC hearings really looked like they had flopped. And then came the Tiangong friendlies. That is, the actors who were screenwriters, most of them, director and a producer, who were accused of communist membership. And by the way, the HUAC papers, which I looked at, had extensive files on these unfriendly, showing that they were they had extensive relations with communists and pretty sound proof that they were members of the Communist Party. Although it should be pointed out that being a member of the Communist Party in 1946 was not illegal. Mm-hmm. The Communist Party was a legal organization. Anyway, they came. They now came before the hearings and tried to disrupt the hearings. They denounced Huac and Parnell as Thomas. They interrupted him, shouted down, tried to shout down the hearings. And there was immediate public backlash to this. It's Americans had just fought a war against fascism, and they might not like Republicans and people like J. Parnell Thomas, but to hear America being denounced as fascist in really rude ways really shocked and outraged people. Mm-hmm. And so by the time the unfriendlies were finished, they had really hurt their case. Liberal actors such as Humphrey Bogart and Laura Bacall and others who had flown out to Washington with great press coverage to support the 10 unfriendlies, they too were shocked by it. They left before the hearings were over, and later Humphrey Bogart told the who hadn't been told that this was the plan to denounce the hearings. Later, told one of the lawyers for the Hollywood for the 10 unfriendly restaurants witnesses that he had really been used. Pretty bad language. They said basically he had been screwed by them.
Yeah.
So liberals deserted them, and it was really a turning point in the fight against communism
mm-hmm.
in Hollywood.
And then, so at that point, I mean, this is a boon for the Republicans. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. J. Parnell, Thomas, for some reason, ended the hearings early. He felt he had proved his point. By the way, he was later indicted and convicted of corruption, kickbacks, employing his own children. actually ended up in the federal prison where one of the Hollywood 10 or the unfriendlies were serving their time for contempt of Congress.
Mm-hmm. That's very rich. So at this point, Richard Milhouse Nixon enters the book, it's always good when Richard Milhouse Nixon enters a book. So how does he? And you say he really this sort of his star rose here. So can you explain that?
Yeah. Well. His was he had been elected to Congress from Southern California, the Whittier area, and was appointed on the Huac committee. And he actually in the hearings when he asked questions, he basically took a position of supporting the studios, asking leading questions to show that communism wasn't really an issue. Ronald Reagan, who was asked questions by Nixon, actually said that we had taken care of the communist problem and there's not a communist problem in his union, the Screen Actors Guild, and this this wasn't really a problem. Indeed, Ronald Reagan, when he was first approached to about testifying, didn't want to testify. He didn't want to be aligned with the Motion Picture Alliance. He thought they were extremists, and he was, but he was convinced to do so. But he, Ronald Reagan, and George Murphy, being good company studio men, basically defended the studios in this, and said there wasn't a communist problem. Anyway, Nixon was going to gain real fame for HUAC for investigating allegations that Alger Hiss, who had been a high-ranking State Department official who had been at the Yalta Conference for post-war planning, was a communist. He had been charged as being a communist by Whitaker Chambers. And Nixon seized upon this evidence, charges, and brought evidence forward from Whitaker Chambers that Alger Hiss wasn't only a communist, but he was a communist spy. And so he became a leading light of the Republican Party, and was going to be put on the presidential ticket with Eisenhower in 1952. Mm-hmm. And if you want, we could talk a little bit about that 52
campaign. Yeah, let's do, please.
Well, so by 1952, you had a pretty active right in Hollywood. It was pretty well formed, but they weren't all of one mind. Some were more conservative than others. Some were more anti-communist than others. They all believed in free enterprise and American patriotism, but they were kind of divided on the communist issue. And many of them supported Robert Taft for the presidency. He had been a long-time Republican senator from Ohio. He was very conservative, and many, including Louis B. Mayer, Henry Hopper, who was a well-known columnist, really didn't like Eisenhower. And so when they went to the Republican convention, they were divided, but when Eisenhower got the nomination, they rallied around him and supported his campaign. And interesting in this, and I think it was an interesting story about the use of modern media in politics, one actor, Robert Montgomery, joined Eisenhower's campaign as a media consultant. And he was so effective that when Eisenhower won, he brought Montgomery with him to the White House to help on television and so forth. He taught Eisenhower well, he didn't teach him, but he told him to use his effective smile, to look at the camera, to keep his shortened sentences short. He built the first White House television studio and used it to really effectively project Eisenhower's image to the larger public.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Nixon is the darling of the Republican Party at this point, and his star has risen. They run him, he loses. And then you have an interesting chapter called The Hollywood Right Goes for Goldwater and Finds Reagan. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, well, Nixon, after he loses the 60 election, and refuses at Eisenhower's advice to use Robert Montgomery as a media consultant, yeah. Which may have hurt him in the great Kennedy Nixon televised debate. he decided to run for governor. The fact of the matter was that two things were happening. First, many in Hollywood had really thought, the hardcore conservatives thought Eisenhower was too moderate. And surprise, surprise, they didn't like Nixon. I know this is surprising for many people, but hardcore Republicans on the right thought Nixon was way too moderate for their taste. The second thing that happened was that in California politics, there really was a significant shift to the right, especially with the emergence of far-right groups such as the John Birch Society. And so Nixon was challenged in the primary by someone on the right. He easily won the primary, but he entered that race against Pat Brown really with a divided party.
Mm-hmm.
And Pat Brown won that election. Hollywood said goodbye to Richard Nixon at that point. They thought his political career was over. Richard Nixon moves to New York with his wife, Pat, and that seems to be the end of Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
So as 1964 approached, the conservatives across the country rallied to bury Goldwater. But within California, many people on the Hollywood right, including the business community, just really didn't like Goldwater. And so in the primaries, leading Republicans who were later going to support Ronald Reagan, Justin Dart and Leonard Firestone, actually endorse in the California primary Goldwater's rival, Nelson Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was another interesting discovery I made, that these Reaganites, some of them, endorsed Rockefeller, who was seen as the liberal Eastern establishment.
Mm-hmm.
But Goldwater did get support from Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan is appointed to head the Citizens Committee for Citizens for Goldwater, an activist organization, and then makes this famous television ad, A Time to Choose, that appeared right 3 days before the election. And from that nationwide televised speech, Ronald Reagan becomes the new hero of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. But this is at the very time, you point this out, it's at the very time in which there are fewer and fewer liberals in Hollywood. I mean, I think one of the things you say is that there's sort of an older generation that is somewhat Republican, but the new generation of actors who are coming into their prime, your Marlon Brando's and such, they are not Republican by any means.
Right. The old Hollywood right actors were getting older. They were no longer film stars. They're turning to TV, as Ronald Reagan had, as the host of the very popular Death Valley Days.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see Barbara Stanwyck turn to television as her husband, Robert Taylor. They just weren't the film stars of the past. You still had John Wayne, who was very popular. Gary Cooper, before he dies, is going to remain pretty popular. But the big film stars that were Republicans just weren't very popular. Ward Bond, who's going to become the star of Wagon Wagon Train, who was a sidekick of Wayne, also turns to Hollywood. And so by 1966, 68, most of the Hollywood stars are television stars. One of the most popular Republican speakers on the campaign trail was Chuck Connors, of The Rifleman. Mm-hmm. Many people thought he was going to have a great political career. Anyway, so in 1966, when Ronald Reagan runs for governor against Pat Brown, what his great accomplishment was to unify the California Republican Party. But by that point, he wasn't going to be able to rely as much on the Hollywood stars, but he still had the business community, Justin Dart and Walter Knox and Leonard Firestone and others behind him. And he runs a very effective campaign and running as kind of a citizen, a union president, not coming from the political class. And he really trounces Pat Brown in the general election. Pat Brown was faced with having been pretty inept in the Watts riot in 65 and campus protest at my alma mater, Berkeley. Reagan really calls for a restoration of law and order, and that appeals to the general public. He wins election in 66 and then wins re-election as governor.
Mm-hmm. And then the indefatigable Reagan eventually becomes president in 1980. He's elected. And this is sort of the highest moment of the Hollywood right. So there he is as president. I guess one question I have is that by the 70s, is there no more Hollywood right except for him and very old Chuck Connors? And I don't know who's alive anymore.
Yeah, well, you have, that's right there. When Reagan runs for president in 1980s, the Hollywood Committee that he forms doesn't have any Hollywood stars. they can't even bring out one after Charles Heston and a few, but they don't have enough to really, advertisements in newspapers with all the stars supporting Reagan because there weren't any.
Right. Yeah.
And you had aging stars like Richard Boone, who Have Gun Will Travel, who was a pretty staunch Republican, but they're not many around. So actually, his Hollywood Committee is made up of studio agents and a few executives. Mm-hmm. It's basically a fundraising operation, but not a media. A part of the media campaign.
Yeah.
So the Democrats are going to be much more effective in using Hollywood stars from that point. One could argue after Clint Eastwood's appearance at the last Republican convention, that the Democrats are going to still be much more effective in using stars. Of course, the question is whether, what effect having endorsements from stars really matters. And I think, Hollywood primarily is a funnel for money, and, I don't think anyone determines their vote on what Barbara Streisand is telling them. At least I don't.
No, I don't think they do, but I think it is a mechanism. To some extent, I don't know who blazed the trail. I want to say it's Reagan, but I doubt it was. That it is a way to find people who have some political talent. For example, I'm thinking of Al Franken. He apparently has some political talent. He got elected senator. Similarly with
right.
Reagan. I can't think of other examples right off the top of my head, but it is a way to launch a political career now. Again, is that thanks to Reagan, or did he have predecessors?
Nope, there were a few actors who have been elected to the California Assembly, but But really, George Murphy, when he's elected U.S. Senator and then followed by Ronald Reagan, I mean, it really shows that what if you're a candidate with a large popular following, that translates into political popularity,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and I would say
you're right about that.
Yeah, but I would also say you have some political talent. Because I don't think most people have any, and I probably don't either, what being an active politician is like, especially on the campaign trail. It's brutal, and not everybody can do it. So I think someone like, you know, obviously Reagan could. Sean Penn can't.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, he'd
Sean
end up
Penn's
calling.
Thinking about.
Well, I don't think he is, but he would end up in his first press conference calling somebody an MF, and it would be over.
Right.
You know, he just
right.
doesn't have the chops
Absolutely.
For it. You know, he just doesn't have the
well,
chops.
There's two aspects, I think, to this, and it's embodied in Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan had an affable manner that came across on television. And that matters. You know, television and film kind of capture one's personality. But there was also something else that Ronald Reagan had. He was very, very pragmatic and an extremely adept politician. He had his core principles, but during the campaign, as I discussed when Hollywood was right, in his gubernatorial campaigns and presidential campaigns, he really compromised and brought people together within a very highly factionalized Republican Party. So it's just not having a easy manner in front of the television cameras. One needs to also know how to run a campaign and make those tough political decisions,
right.
Which I think a lot of Hollywood actors who are basically in complete control, they want someone they don't like what they're doing, they could fire them right away or cuss them out.
Right.
So you need to have some political skills as well.
That's just what I was pointing out. Is, you know, they bring a platform with them, as they say in, you know, book publishing, but whether they can actually write a book, that's an open question. And someone like Reagan could in spades. He had leadership skill, and he had developed it in
right.
a union. And, you know, it's not like he was inexperienced. He had shown that he could do it in another sphere. So anyway, I want to ask
right.
you two questions before we go very quickly. And the first one is, why did now Hollywood was always sort of more liberal than conservative, but there's this moment of conservatism. Why did it become, maybe this is the wrong characterization. Why and how did it become completely liberal? Are there Republican,
yeah.
I mean, who's that? I'm trying to think of any.
Well, there's a resurgence of Republicanism, mostly libertarianism in Hollywood today. But Hollywood has always been liberal, even I think during the Red Scare mm-hmm. period. You know, it's an artistic community. But I think it swings further to the left with the breakup of the studios, independent filmmaking, and like much of the country and that generation, the Vietnam War and Black Civil Rights protest really swing a lot of actors who are on the left further to the left.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the 1970s, late 60s, 70s, kind of personified in Jane Fonda are really, you know, really a turn away from that kind of old New Deal liberalism to a kind of, you know, further left liberal and even, you know, kind of further left as seen in Sean Penn and others in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. So, and then the second question, which obviously follows from the first, you've mentioned it. You mentioned this resurgence. Is there any chance that Hollywood will move to the, I don't like this right left thing, but we'll just say to the right or to the Republican cause. Is there any chance that that's ever going to happen in like the recent future or the near future?
Well, I think politics is really changing in America. In teaching, you know, I'm teaching, so I speak to a lot of young people. And I think those categories of right and left are really becoming skewed.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a hard time telling actually what the politics of my politically active students are sometimes. They tend to be very, very libertarian. So they're anti-war, anti-government, not loyal to, they think both political parties are corrupt. They're kind of anti-corporate and so forth. And but, you know, they could be on the left and they could be on the right.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of anger out there and a lot of loss of trust in our government, which is good in some ways for democracy, but not very good on the other hand if we all distrust our government. So I think politics is changing. I think Hollywood politics will change too. That old breed of leftist Hollywood is, you know, they'll still be out there, but it's kind of a dying breed, I think, in some ways, as politics is going to change in this country.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, and I would agree with you when I ask my students questions which I think have obvious answers. They don't have obvious answers to them, and I'm really surprised by this. I mean, I truly am just gobsmacked. Sometimes I'll ask them a question, and I won't give any examples, but it's just not what sort of right-thinking people, at least what I thought right-thinking people thought. And I was
unaware. Well, I think the other thing that's apparent that also sets a context for American politics is the general apathy of most people, but also kind of the political ignorance. I mean, students just don't know kind of basic things about American history. And
oh my God,
you might not want to give an example, but I'll give an example. Just 2 years ago in an introductory to U.S. class, I gave a throwaway line on the first day of class, trying to get the students to relax. I asked who the president was during the Civil War. This is before the Lincoln film.
Mm-hmm.
But not a single student knew. And it wasn't that they didn't try to answer the question.
Yeah.
Many thought it was Ulysses S. Grant.
Yeah.
I mean, and so we're confronting this kind of breakdown in civic literacy, which is fundamental to a democracy.
Right. Well, that's what we hear about at the New Books Network. I will give one example because it so shocked me, and it's partially because I'm a Midwesterner. And I asked, we're discussing terrorism, and I said, name an act of domestic terrorism before 9/11. And they couldn't name one. They didn't know about the Oklahoma City bombing.
Right.
I mean, how can you not know about the Oklahoma City bombing? How is that possible?
Actually, I've had many students who had never heard of the Oklahoma City bombing.
Incredible. I mean, that's not good. It's not good. And I feel personally a little bit guilty because obviously I'm not doing my job because, like, that's just bad. They should know about that. So anyway, we're both doing our jobs. I think we can say that. So we can feel good about ourselves. So thank you very much for being on the show, Don. And I want to close with our traditional final question, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, I just finished a very short introduction to American political history that's going to be published by Oxford University Press.
Mm-hmm.
And so because I'm concerned with, you know, giving kind of writing a short book that maybe will instruct our students on things like Oklahoma City bombing.
Let's hope.
And who the president was during the Civil War. I'm thinking about a book called Democracy in America, really talking about kind of the problems that we're confronting right now in our democracy. Mm-hmm. and the future of American democracy. So I've written a proposal. It's off to an agent. If I get a contract, then I'll write that book. If not, I might go off to the Bahamas and never write another book.
I prompted Don to say that.
It's gotten very tough to get books published these days, by the way, as you know.
Oh, boy, and how. So, you know, well, as I say, one of the things that we do on the show is that we try to get the word out about books like yours, good books, and we want people to read them, so we kind of give them a taste by having them listen to you talk about the book. So then they'll go out, and they will buy your book, and you will earn enough money to get that place in the Bahamas. You can go and retire. Okay. I don't know if it's going to happen, but that's our goal.
Well, I hope people do buy and read anyway. When Hollywood was right, I don't think I'm going to earn enough to go off to the Bahamas. And plus, I'm fair-skinned. All I would is get a bad sunburn, so they can save me.
But if
they read the book, When Hollywood Was Right, I would greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, it would be great. So anyway, let me thank you for being on the show, first of all.
And thank you.
Absolutely. And then let me say to everybody who listens to this podcast, thank you very much for listening to the New Books Network. We really appreciate all of your support, and I hope that everybody has a great week.